You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We have got a jam-packed show for you today featuring Brighton writer Marisa Linden, who is here to talk about her debut young adult book, The Binding Spell. Kerry Downs joins us to talk about her debut novel, That Time Everything Was on Fire. And Jill Johnson joins us to speak about the next book in her Eustacia Rose cozy crime series, Belladonna. We are also joined by Althea Wolfe, who is here to tell us about the wonderful Brighton Book Festival, which is back in Brighton from the 18th to the 22nd of June. And E.C. Nevin is here to talk about her book, A Novel Murder, which is biting satire on the publishing industry set at a literary festival. You can listen to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb through the month, and it's also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. If you have an idea for the show, you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com, and you can also follow us on Instagram at btmbookclub. If you want to win a copy of Eve's fantastic A Novel Murder, you can find out how to do so over on our Instagram page. Enjoy the show. What lies beneath must stay hidden. Morgan hopes her nightmares are behind her. Meeting Joe Harper helps. His secrets seem as tangled as hers, and their time together is magic. But Morgan's bad dreams return when her archaeologist father begins work at a local burial site. With every relic he unearths, a creeping horror emerges, a spell that binds them all. Marisa Linden, welcome to the Brighton Book Club, and congratulations on the publication of your debut young adult book, The Binding Spell.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Anna. It's great to be here.
So when did the idea for this book come to you?
The idea actually came to me when my daughters were very small. So if I tell you they're now in their 20s, you realise this has been going around my head for a long time. I'm a historian by profession originally, so I wrote very dense books with lots of footnotes, some very heavy stuff. And I wanted to write something that my children would enjoy. So I went back to the sorts of books that I read when I was young for pleasure, and the fantasies and folk tales, things like that. And I melded them together into this story that, first of all, I told to my daughters, and then I wrote it down at some length. It became a very, very long story. And at the end of that, I thought, well, this is unpublishable. So I put it to one side, but That's its origin.
And why folk horror and witchcraft? What is it that excites you about the genre?
Folk horror, I think, it's great fun, actually. But and I like to write things that are not full on horror. I'm not into that, but things that are scary, things that make the reader energized and make the reader imagine what's going to happen next. I like raising that sense of anticipation. So that's where that horror element comes from. The folk thing, I like old stories. I like things that come out of the ancient past, and folk tales were originally stories that adults told to one another. Sort of around the fires at night, winter evenings, and such tales tap into a long, half-forgotten past. Also, folk horror happens to be having a bit of a moment, but I started writing, as you could see, a long time before it became a moment, just because I love it. It's fun, it's entertaining, and it's scary. I like all of that.
Can we hear an extract, please?
Sure, I would love to read it. This is a very short extract. So Morgan has come to live in this remote house with her younger siblings. The locals call it the witch's house, which tells you something already about it. And it's night, and she can't sleep. She's with her younger sister, Callie, who basically Morgan's pretty much a young carer to. Morgan lay wide-eyed in the dark, The burn mark throbbed whenever it scraped against the rough cotton sheet. Callie, refusing to stay in her own room, slept alongside her, cradling Wallace, a cuddly hedgehog. Outside, the wind shook the window like something was trying to get in. Callie stirred, rolled over. Morgan went to the window and pulled back the curtains. Chilly air blew onto her face from the gap between the window jambs. The window rattled violently. She remembered the wedge of paper that had been plugging the gap, found it lying half unrolled on the window seat. She picked it up, meaning to refold it and push it into the gap. Something caught her eye, lines scrawled onto the paper. She made out drawings done in crude, rough lines with charcoal. The first was some kind of animal with pointed ears and whiskers, a cat perhaps. It had been horribly mutilated, its throat cut, its entrails ripped out. Alongside it was a human-shaped figure, upside down. It had been decapitated. A gush of charcoal black blood poured from the neck. The severed head lay nearby, mouth gaping, eyes open and staring. Across the bottom of the page, one word was written in shaky capitals, Pookus.
It's so wonderful and so atmospheric. Thank you so much. The character of Morgan is absolutely lovely. She's unforgettable, and she's an excellent protagonist. How did she develop in your mind over the years?
I wanted my protagonist to be a girl, obviously female myself, and Morgan had. She's been through a lot in her young life. She and her siblings, they lost their mother when Morgan was 12. I also lost my mother quite young, and my father found that very difficult to cope with. My father basically had a full-on breakdown. That is in the story. So I didn't think it through at the time I was writing. I just wrote the story. But I sort of think Morgan is a bit me. She's been through this loss, this grief, and she has to face a world where most other kids aren't like her. They haven't had that kind of loss, or not so many kids have. But I was the youngest in my family. So I was actually a bit more like her twin brother, Johnny, who becomes this sort of bit of a tearaway, bit of a reprobate, quite wild. I was actually more like a Johnny, I have to say. But Morgan takes over the care of her younger siblings, and so she becomes responsible at an early age. She resents it, but she does it because her dad's not really up to it. So she becomes this effectively a young carer, and she's trying to protect her younger brother and sister, and that is a big driver for her throughout the story, is keep them safe. And so in a sense, Morgan is the person I might have been if I'd had younger siblings. There you are, a psychoanalytical account of what was going on, but really essentially it's a story. And I try not to dwell too much on the bad stuff in her life, because it is a fantasy. It's sort of transfigured, it's escapism, and I wanted to dwell on the empowering side of life for her, not make her a victim.
You spoke a bit earlier on about about reading fantasy growing up. What were the books that really formed you?
The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. It was the first proper book I ever read, as opposed to kind of a, you know, like, this is Janet, this is John books. My sister, I had a big sister. She read the first page and then she wandered off. And I'm like, what happened next? What happened? And so I forced myself to read. I can remember how the book looked, the illustrations, the Pauline Baynes illustrations, and the struggle at first to read the words, but then it got easier. And I think being immersed in that kind of fantasy world, I knew nothing about C.S. Lewis then, but being immersed in that world really just shaped my imagination at a really young age. So much so that I actually read The Lord of the Rings at 8, which is a bit ridiculous. But my big brother, because I'd already read The Hobbit by that stage, and I said, is there anything more like this? And he said, well, there's this thing, The Lord of the Rings, we can get it from the library. And I struggled through it. I didn't, at 8, to be honest, I didn't read every bit of it, because all the stuff about elves and battles, that's quite tough. But I skim read those bits, but the stuff I dwelt on is Frodo, and Sam and Gollum. Loved it, loved it. And Sam became my first book hero. He's this sort of quiet, he starts out as the gardener, the servant, and he really becomes the quiet hero of the book, the working class man. Although I didn't think about any of that, obviously, at the age of eight, but I think that's a great storyline. And I loved it. Yeah. I came back at the age of nine, read it through properly then. It's the thing, there was nothing much else to do when I was little. You played, but reading, if you wanted to find out what happened, no film versions. So I still love Tolkien in many ways. But when I was 12, I came to the books again. I was finally given my own copies by my parents and read them. And at 12, I thought, where are the women? Wanted stories that had relationships in and women, of course. So put Tolkien aside a bit and went on to many other books. Yes.
And then you wrote your own with the women at the heart, which is amazing. So, Marisa, you had a slightly unconventional yet very lovely journey to publication. I'd love to hear a bit about that.
Well, I rewrote The Binding Spell and then I rewrote it, made it much shorter, and I hoped much more readable. And I queried it with agents and got absolutely nowhere. One said to me, well, it's very, very hard to sell YA and the advances are really small. And have you thought of writing a book for adults? So I wrote another and I got absolutely nowhere. It's quite daunting, quite demoralizing. But there was nothing else I really wanted to do. This I knew I put it off for a very long time, wanted, and I was working freelance by then. I knew I'd never make a lot of money at it, but it was what I wanted to do. So I tried a few things. One of them was I put The Binding Spell. It was at that time called The Pooka King. I put that into the Times Chicken House competition for writers of children's and young adult literature. I thought it had no chance because, well, for one thing, I thought nobody wanted my book, but also Chicken House. I thought usually they went for books for younger children. But I entered it at the last minute. A friend talked me into it. And yeah, it got longlisted. Amazing. It got shortlisted. Oh my God. And then came the day when they announced the winners. It was in a big do, the big breakfast it's called that Chicken House has at Foyles in London, and there are seven judges and it's all a big, big shebang. There are agents and publishers and all sorts of people, scouts who go along to see what's happening. And it won. It won. I c literally could not believe it. I was rooted to the spot when they said my book had won. I thought they'd made a mistake, sort of classic imposter syndrome. Are you sure? Are you really sure? They were lovely. They were lovely, absolutely lovely. They gave me a bunch of flowers and a badge, but also they published the book as The Binding Spell. And I knew in some part of me that the moment they called it out, that was it. That was going to be my career as a fiction writer. I knew that everything had changed. And so, yeah, that was absolutely a fantastic moment for me. Every time I think about it still, it makes me smile because of what happened. It was lovely.
It's lovely. It gives me goosebumps. So, Marisa, you are a writer in Brighton. How have you got involved in the community here, and how has it helped you on your kind of journey to become a published author?
Well, before I started putting my fiction out there, I didn't talk to anybody about my fiction. I was quite shy about it. I thought it wasn't much good, total imposter syndrome, and was very wary of showing anyone my writing. But at the moment when I knew that I wanted to try and write for publication, I knew I had to overcome this because you can't be published if you won't let people read it. You have to take that step. So I took that step. It's quite a big one. It's quite a big one because you feel quite vulnerable. You're opening up yourself as a person, because these words came out of your head. And if people don't like them, then it shouldn't be personal, but it feels very much so. So I did that and I joined several writing groups, and they have been absolutely wonderful. They have kept me going, and I hope I have kept other people going as well. And some of these groups, a couple of them were actually, three of them were online, because obviously that's how things happen. But also I joined writing groups in Brighton, including the West Hill Writers, and that was lovely. I felt I'd found my tribe of people who were supportive and cared and understood, who actually really get it, how tough it is. And my recommendation to anybody out there writing who is not yet published and feels despondent is to find your writing group and to share that experience with people, because they become your writing friends, and that's huge. I mean, your family, they care about you, but they've seen you be depressed by rejection, and I think a part of them thinks, well, why not do something else? Huh. But for me, there was no something else. I wouldn't have been any good as at anything else. I always known it, writing was my thing. And so to get to meet people who for whom that is a thing is huge. And take that step, obviously, and share your writing with them. A good writing group will they will critique your writing, hopefully, give you advice, but from a really positive place. It's so important to feel supported, especially in the early stages. It's so easy to knock someone back. If your writing group knocks you back, leave them immediately. But find people who will build you up, and encourage you.
Absolutely. Marisa, thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you?
You can find me on my Instagram account, mlinton8. Also, can I just say one more thing? I wrote, as I said, a book for adults, an adult fantasy, which was also rejected by the agents. Because I won Chicken House, people became interested, and it's now coming out, that book, in a two-book deal, which I can't publicly talk about because they haven't made the announcement, but it will be. So yeah, I've got three books coming out from being at a point of zero, which feels great.
This is super inspiring. Thank you so much for joining us. The Binding Spell is out now with Chicken House. Sam and Daisy have been best friends since university. Back then, Daisy was a wild Fleetwood Mac obsessed girl from the Yorkshire Moors, while Sam's youth was misspent traipsing around Liverpool on shopping trips and nights out. But as they lean against each other on a wooden bench in the tired garden of their beloved local pub, gazing out at Sam's wedding, they have no idea that their paths are about to truly diverge for the first time. As Sam's desire to become a mother consumes her, and Daisy's inability to resist temptation haunts her, these best of friends will lose sight of themselves and each other. With each misstep and unintentional betrayal, the gulf widens. But can they build a bridge, or will they let it burn? Kerry Downs, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That Time Everything Was on Fire is a glorious book, and I would love to hear about how your very distinctive protagonists, Sam and Daisy, came to you.
Oh, thank you very much. I think it was initially Sam's voice that came to me. I think her sort of story is more based on the kind of infertility route, which some of it is based on personal experience. So kind of that came about first. And when I first started writing it, sort of about 5 years ago now, I was actually living with my best friend. And I guess the sort of Daisy storyline came about from her because we were in quite kind of different points of our life. Sort of maybe for the first time, really. We've been friends since university, and it just gave me this kind of idea of, oh, what if, people's lives started to really diverge, and how could that affect a friendship? So Daisy's voice kind of came later, I guess. And I found it quite difficult initially at because we've got the dual point of views, each chapter is alternates between the two. And I found it quite difficult carving out their individual voices because I do think you tend to speak in a similar way to your friends who you've been, friends with a decade. So kind of having them speak in a very a different way kind of was a bit of a challenge actually.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I can imagine that. One thing that I really loved about the book is that you show, like you said, the divulgence of friendships in your 30s in all its kind of messy, complicated glory. Was this so, you mentioned that this kind of came a bit from personal experience, but was this based on a lot of the relationships that you saw around you too? And how have your kind of peers reacted to the book?
Well, none of them have read it yet, so we'll find out. Because yeah, today's publication day. So in the last week, I've been getting lots of friends like holding up their copies and photos, which has been really lovely. I mean, I hope they all love it. I mean, I think I've probably created more conflict in the book than I have experienced in my real life, just because it's more interesting to read about, I guess. So I guess some of the storylines and themes are based on my experiences, but some are sort of fabricated for interest, I guess.
Absolutely. One of the things, as you mentioned, that you draw on is your own journey of fertility treatment. And recently, you've had a very highly read article in The Guardian about the things not to say to women who are going through fertility treatment. This is your first book. Do you feel like you couldn't have avoided writing about this thing that has been so important to you in your life?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably, yeah. I'd made a few attempts at writing books previously, but I'd never really sort of got past like 10,000 words, and I think I needed like a real passion project. And at the time when I started writing it, I'd had two failed rounds of fertility treatment, and because it was 2020, kind of all IVF treatment was postponed. So it was kind of on hold indefinitely. So that's when I kind of started writing it as a sort of cathartic exercise, to some extent. But then it became more of a escapism in some ways, in sort of writing, some of the lovely parts and the friendship and sort of escaping in these characters, and in a way, kind of taking back control, because you can control the narrative of their lives. And it was a time when I felt like I didn't have much control over certain parts of my own life. So yeah, I think it is unavoidable. I think I always would have written about it.
Thing that plays quite an important role in the book is music. There feels like quite there's a distinctive soundtrack running through the book. Was that something you wrote consciously?
It wasn't actually, and yeah, that's a, I'm really pleased to hear that that's come across. I think just, like most people, I love music, and I think I'm always quite, I guess, emotionally affected by certain songs. So sometimes if I was kind of trying to write quite an emotionally heavy scene, I'd kind of listen to music on a walk to think about it. So yeah, I wonder if it's kind of come from that aspect, but I think it's probably just from my own personal experience of associating music heavily with emotions that it's kind of bled into the book.
Absolutely. So I would love to know a little bit about your journey to publication, Kerry. I'm always really fascinated by how something goes from an idea to a book in our hands. Was your journey straightforward?
I don't know. I guess in some ways, yes. I feel very fortunate. So I started kind of taking my writing seriously by joining up to a Curtis Brown online novel writing course, which I know a lot of debuts have done. I had very little experience of writing apart from A-level English. I knew nothing about the publishing industry. So that was really kind of instrumental in teaching me about everything from punctuation to getting an agent and how to query and all that sort of formalizing it all. And also just getting confident at sharing my work. It feels very exposing, sort of showing people something you've written. And it was much easier to do with essentially strangers on the course than giving it to a relative or a friend would have. I just couldn't have bared to have done that at the beginning. So yeah, I found the Curtis Brown course really helpful. I then queried, so it took me about 9 months to write the first draft and then edited it a little bit, ended up getting an agent actually with Curtis Brown. And then she helped me edit it quite a lot. She used to be an editor, so her input was amazing. I'd actually just had a baby kind of a few weeks before I signed with her. So the editing was slow. So we took a while editing it and then went on submission. I was on submission for a while because I had a few kind of interests that didn't come through. But yeah, eventually got a deal with HQ in HarperCollins, which was amazing. And yeah, here we are on
Yeah.
publication day.
The rest is history. So, Kerry, you are a writer based in Brighton. Are there particular places that you like to write, and how does the city kind of inspire you?
Yeah, so I moved here only 2 years ago. I still feel quite new and just completely in awe of Brighton, I would say. It's definitely the most creative place I've ever lived. I feel like there's so many writers that people are just kind of like, all oh, right, you're a writer, like in a nice way. It's very humbling. So yeah, I mostly write at home, or I live near Seven Dials, so I write in a couple of cafes around there. And yeah, I love it in Brighton.
It's a very inspiring place full of writers, which I think, yeah, in many ways it's good. It means that you don't feel like you stick out too much, but you also feel like you're in very, very good company.
Definitely. I joined a local writing group when I came down as well. And yeah, that's been really supportive and also I think just helped me really kind of settle into Brighton. Just being part of such a lovely group and having that weekly meetup. So yeah, I really love my writing group here.
Excellent. What's next for you, Kerry? You tell me that you've just handed in your next manuscript. Can you give us a little clue about the book?
Yes, I have. So I had a two-book deal. It's my second book. It's not related to the first book. A lot of people have asked me, is it a follow-on? It's not. And I found that actually, I think it would have been easier if it was a follow-on. It was the kind of decision of what to write next I found just huge and overwhelming. So I guess there are similar themes in that it's kind of a coming of age story, but a bit younger, set at sort of university, so kind of early 20s. It's a bit of a love story. There's quite a lot around sort of identity in there, some disability themes. So yeah, I'm excited about it. I've just handed it to my editor, so I'm sort of praying that she won't hate it.
Kerry, thank you so much for joining us and congratulations. That Time Everything Was on Fire is out now with HQ. Eustacia Rose is done with murder cases. She's ready to settle down with her partner, Mathilde, and focus on her work at the university to live a normal life. But then along comes a case she can't resist investigating, because this time the murder victim was poisoned with hemlock, one of the plants stolen from Eustacia's illicit garden of poisonous plants. And Eustacia is not the only one desperate to retrieve her lost treasure. the beguiling trader of rare plants, Zaza, and a rival university professor, Hutchins, are on the trail too. Not to mention the dangerous criminal gang determined to keep hold of the lethal plants. The stakes are higher than ever for Eustacia because if she cannot save her plants in time, there will be more deaths, and this time the blood will be on her hands. Belladonna is the third book in the Eustacia Rose series, and Jill Johnson joins me to talk about the book. Jill, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
It's fabulous to have you back and great that you are so prolific. I mean, you have written a book every year for the last 3 years. How do you do it?
I'm asked this question a lot because I also have a full-time job. So it is pretty much right in the morning, do my job, right in the evening, right on the weekends. Every holiday I take is to write. So I've become a little bit of a writing hermit.
And do you plan, how, did you plan the whole series before you started? So we're on the third out of four books now. Did you know what was going to happen in this one when you started?
I had a vague idea. It was quite an interesting process because I only had a book deal for one book. Even though I knew I wanted to write four books, my agent said, well, let's just go for one book and it has to be a standalone book. But I actually left, after the first book, I left some threads untied because I knew that I was going to try and persuade the publisher to do another book. And we managed to get the publisher to give me a two-book deal after the first one. And so this is the third that this is the second of that two book deal. And then we managed to get them to do one more, which is the one I'm writing now. So I set out to write four books, but it took a little while for my publisher to catch up with me.
So, for anyone who isn't aware of the books, the plants basically play a very big role in the book and in the mysteries, and with this wonderful amateur sleuth, Eustacia Rose. Why plants?
Because I did a degree in horticulture and I was talking to my agent back in 2017 because my very first book was a historical novel and that came out in 2018. And just before that came out, I said, well, what shall I write next? And my agent said, well, what do you know about? So I said, well, I know about plants. So that was it. Okay, write something that involves plants. And then I went to the Alnwick Poison Garden a long time ago. And so I had this connection of all poisonous plants. If I'm going to write about poisonous plants, there has to be a death. If there's going to be a death, then I'd quite like to write a crime novel and I'd like it to be a series. And yeah, so it all started developing around a conversation with my agent. It was actually in Barcelona, this conversation, by a swimming pool with a glass of wine. So it turned out to be a very fruitful little convo.
Absolutely. So Eustacia's voice must just live rent-free in your head constantly because you are with her,
She's,
like
yeah.
you said, constantly. How is it going to feel when you finish the series?
Well, fingers crossed, fingers and toes crossed. It's been optioned. So hopefully, whenever I want to have a little fix of Eustacia, I can just sort of re-watch whatever they're going to do with her for the TV. So I think she's going to be with me forever.
That's amazing. Congratulations. Are you writing on the TV show?
No, I'm advising. So they have a script writer. I can't talk too much about it, but they have a quite a well-known script writer who is putting together the deck. It's called a pitch deck, which they will take to commissioners. So that's where we are at the moment.
Congratulations.
They will. They're going to ask me questions, and I'm very happy to help in any way I can.
Amazing. Jill, can we hear a little extract, please?
There is a large Victorian building in Kentish Town, fronted by 21 tall sash windows and accessed via wide steps leading up to an imposing arched entrance. Either side of the steps are flower beds planted with dirt-spotted laurel bushes, fed by cigarette butts and empty crisp packets. In the Portland stone surrounding the arch is a carved word, police, and in front of this is a four-panelled blue glass street lamp, the old-fashioned kind, with that same word etched onto all four panels, leaving the passerby in no doubt as to the purpose of this building. Through the dark wooden door is the reception with heavily worn blue plastic bench seating, a payphone, and a glassed-off area containing the front desk, the duty officer, and the door that leads to a disorientating warren of windowless corridors, rooms, suites, and holding cells. The building is tired, desperately in need of redecoration. It smells of anger and frustration. Its floors are stained with despair. It is not a place one enters voluntarily. In fact, it's a place most people try to avoid at all costs. But I am not most people. I am Professor Eustacia Amelia Rose, Head of Botanical Toxicology at University College London, and I had chosen to walk through the arched entrance and across the reception to the glassed-off area. I wasn't here to make a complaint or to report a crime, and I certainly wasn't here to hand myself in. I was here because I'd received a phone call from Detective Chief Inspector Roberts not 15 minutes before, and it was imperative I find out why.
Thank you so much. Then there must be a fair amount of research that goes into writing these books. Where do you do your research?
Well, I have been back to the Annick Poison Garden, and I've developed quite a good relationship with the guides there. And every time I go, they give me another big wadge of research, poisonous plants research, and historical murders caused by poisonous plants. So they are my like number one source. But I also have my gardener's encyclopedia, my RHS encyclopedia of plants and flowers that I've had since I was, oh gosh, in my mid-20s. And I use that a lot. In fact, I have so many. I'm looking at them now on my shelf beside me. I have so many books on poisonous plants. Wicked Plants is a really, really good one by Amy Stewart. It's really well known, and you probably recognise the cover. So I dip into that every now and again. There's a lot out there. There's a lot that I turn to when I need it.
So I love an amateur sleuth, and we actually have another excellent amateur sleuth on this episode of the Brighton Book Club. But I'd love to know which authors, and particularly crime and mystery authors, have inspired you.
I think I'm quite unusual in that I'm not a crime fiction reader. The only writer that I've read is Agatha Christie. And a little bit of P.D. James. But otherwise, I haven't read any sort of contemporary crime writers at all. And I recently went to a crime writers festival, and I didn't know anybody there. And everybody knew everybody, and everybody knew the people up on stage doing the talking, and I'd never heard of any of them or any of their books. And so I felt like a little bit of a fraud being there. But I think it has helped me in that a lot of the comments I've had about the books is for people who like crime fiction, but a little bit different. Mm. So I don't think my books follow the genre or what's, I'm sure that there are acts that you're meant to follow in a crime crime novel, but I don't think mine follow those rules at all.
So you, Jill, are a writer in Brighton. What do you love about being an author in the city?
Oh, Brighton. I absolutely love Brighton. I haven't been here that long. I came down from London. I'm a down from Londoner, dear fella, as they call us in Brighton. But the writing community down here is just so inclusive and caring and encouraging. It's just, and there are so many things. There's all sorts of groups and book groups and little festivals starting up now down here. Yeah, it's, yeah, I think my new friends down here that I've made in the last few years are my writer friends. Yeah, it's a brilliant place to be a writer.
Jill, thank you so much for joining us. How can we find and follow you?
You can find me on Instagram at Jill Johnson Writes, on Blue Sky, writer Jill Johnson, Threads as well, the same as Instagram.
Thank you very much. So Belladonna is out now with Black and White Publishing, which is an imprint of Bonnier. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brighton Book Festival is back in June and runs from the 18th to the 22nd. And one of the directors of the festival, Abia Wolf, joins me to tell us more. Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you, Anna. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
So what can we look forward to this year?
So I think we have got the most exciting programme that we've had in 4 years. And I think you're probably thinking, we've heard that before, but we really have. We really have topped ourselves this year. I think we've got a programme that really and truly supports our mission and showcases our mission to the general public. We have marginalized authors. We have more established authors with strong reputations, well-known authors. So, you know, and that's our mission. That's our mission, is to combine those two. And this year in particular, we are being really innovative in terms of getting authors out there to audiences. And so we're really excited that we are kicking off the festival on the 18th with a theatre performance, a one-man theatre show. Have a look at our website. It's called Sancho and Me. And we also, in the family festival, we end the family festival with a show by Athena Kugblenu called History's Most Epic Fibs. Who wouldn't want to be there to hear those? What do we actually know and believe about history that isn't true? And that's taking place in the Jubilee Library. So I think we're being really creative with what we're presenting this year.
Absolutely. So the festival was established a few years ago with a mission to make the marginalised mainstream. Can you talk a bit about the journey of the festival over the last few years?
Yeah, well, I think I'll set it in the context of my own personal journey with the festival. So I started, I came to the very first festival as a volunteer, and I still remember the day I walked into Afore Books and said, oh, I'll volunteer for Brighton Book Festival. Had no idea that I would be doing this 4 years later in this capacity, but I'm really pleased. I think that time, the festival was just a weekend. It was a Friday to Sunday. The Feminist Bookshop was involved at that stage with Ruth. And not only has the festival grown in that time, since then, in terms of numbers, audience numbers, it's grown in the length of the festival. So, you know, we're having a 5-day festival just from a weekend festival. And I think what I would say is, in terms of the mission, making the marginalized mainstream, we have really been able to push authors who wouldn't generally have a platform to the forefront. And we can see that we have someone for the first time. It's the first festival. And then we can see that it gives them the confidence to approach other festivals and other events. And so they're appearing everywhere. So I think, I think in terms of our mission, we've really, really been pushing through and growing that concept. The other thing I would say is we are beginning to build up a dedicated following over the years. So I think that's really really nice. We appreciate you all. And we are building capacity in the community. So just like me being a volunteer and coming through and then becoming a director of the festival, we actually have loads, well, we've had quite a few examples of people who've been volunteers who have come and worked at the festival, actually got paid work through the festival. And so we're building capacity within marginalized communities as well. It's an incredible journey in terms of there's so many different elements of growth and so many different ways that Brighton Book Festival is giving back to the city. And I think actually after this festival, we need to just sit and reflect on that a bit more, because you're so busy doing it that you don't always actually have time to sit down and think, wow, we did that. And I have to say, since Brighton Book Festival, I mean, there's Coastie Square has obviously been around for probably the same time as us, a year before we
a bit longer,
were there.
Yeah, since 2019.
So 2 years before the book festival, I think. And now we've got two other festivals in the city. So, yeah, I think, you know, it shows that there's an appetite.
Absolutely. So I just want to have a quick chat about the actual program. Can you just name two or three standout events that you think people really need to know about?
That's not fair. Okay. So I'm going to speak from my personal perspective again. Mm-hmm. I think Sancho and Me, that's our launch event, one man show by Patterson Joseph. If you miss that, you are missing a real treat. So I definitely think that's on the 18th. It's at the Bright Helm. And I think that's one that you have to come to. The Long List, which is two authors who there's a big buzz around. They've been shortlisted. They were both longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. So that's Kalyanne Bradley, Ministry of Time, and Nasiba Yunus, who wrote Fundamentally. That's going to be a live, going out live as a podcast on hosted by Dorothy Coombs on her Dorothy Edit podcast. So I think that's one you shouldn't miss. And Keep Up the Good Fight. That's or the event to close the festival. Keep Up the Good Fight. All about activism, really a big Brighton topic. And we've got Dr. Shola, who a lot of people will be following on social media. And she'll be accompanied by Keio Yoshida and Gina Tonic. I think those are the three ones that I definitely will not be missing.
Thank you so much, Athia. I'm so looking forward to the festival. How can people get tickets and how can people support the festival if they're not able to make it?
Okay, so we've got our website, which is brightonbookfestival.co.uk. Tickets are on sale on that website, also via Eventbrite. So any of those two platforms. In terms of supporting the festival, volunteers, we need volunteers so people can actually click on our website. There's a volunteer button. Click on that, fill out the form. We'll never say no. You know, we need volunteers. Buying tickets via the website. And if you can't make it to the festival, you can't buy tickets, please consider doing a pay it forward or donating. There's a donation button on the website as well.
Thank you.
Those are the best ways to support us.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anna. Lovely to be with you as always. And thanks for your constant support of the festival.
It's my pleasure. So to close off the show today, I'm actually breaking one of my own rules because Eve isn't a Brighton writer, nor is the book set in Brighton. But a writer friend actually lent me a proof of this book over Christmas and I devoured it. And I thought it was so much fun that I really wanted it to be put on everyone's reading lists. And for everyone who's a regular listener of the show, they will know that I am simultaneously fascinated, surprised, and sometimes appalled by the publishing industry and the strangeness of it all. So I'm really, really looking forward to talking about this book, which is a biting, funny satire, cozy crime set in a very thinly disguised Harrogate book festival. So here is the blurb. In the quaint town of Hulswip, the biggest names in crime writing have congregated to celebrate all things bookish and murderous. With a programme packed with seminars and signings, egos and alcohol, it is sure to be a thrilling weekend. Author Jane Hepburn is determined that this is going to be her year. She's not quite reached the heady heights of bestsellerdom yet, but is convinced that if she can just make the right connections at the festival, it could be the start of a whole new chapter for her and her books. Then her literary agent is killed and Jane's plans are derailed. But if she can solve the murder, perhaps it will provide the boost her writing career needs. If she lives to tell the tale, that is. Set in the world of books and for fans of Richard Osman and Richard Coles, Janice Hallett and Nita Price, A Novel Murder is the book you will be dying to read. Eve, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're an author now, but you have been an editor for years and specifically working on crime and thrillers. Can you tell us a bit about the transition from editor and creator of books to writer of one?
Yeah, so I always wanted to be a writer. I think people in the industry are split. Some people think the idea of being an author is horrendous and they would never want to do it. And then there's the others like me who are secretly plotting to move over to the other side. And so I was always wanted to do it, but I couldn't do it while I worked in a publishing house. You have no time and you have to look at other people's books all day and often all night. So it was impossible. So I left and I went freelance and they had a bit more time. And then I managed to finally write a book. And now that's what I do. It's amazing. I love being on the other side.
So, as I said, this is cozy crime with a delightful amateur sleuth, Jane Hepburn, at the heart of it, who's a kind of mid-list author, really, trying to hit the big time. For me, it's a really biting satire on the publishing industry. You must have had so much fun writing it and getting all that kind of like weird, juicy stuff out on the table.
It was really fun. There were moments I had to kind of step back and remind myself that I'm supposed to be writing a book for other people's enjoyment and not partaking in a therapy session or, you know, just getting out just revenge on the page, you know, trying to sort of rework a whole plot just to get in a sideswipe at an old boss. So I had to like restrain myself a bit. But yeah, it was really fun. And it was fun to use like knowledge and experience and sometimes annoying things that have happened to you and your friends as a backdrop for a fun mystery. And I think it's an industry some people are interested in as well, a bit like the TV world. People like a sort of peek behind the curtain a bit. So yeah, it was really fun to help people see what it's like.
Absolutely. Can you read us, please, from the prologue?
Yeah, so this is just the very start of the book. It's the prologue. Friday, 5 a.m. Novels aren't good for you, thinks Jane Hepburn, as she stares down at the body of her literary agent. The Victorians had it right. What good can filling your head with invented horrors do? People like to blame video games for inspiring violence, but Jane is standing in a tent surrounded by books crammed with the stuff. Serial killers, assassins, women who murder their husbands and friends who knock each other off on holiday, men who trick women with amnesia, women who fake their own deaths for revenge, clowns who emerge from sewers to torment children. And now there's a real-life corpse on the floor. It is the second day of the Killer Lions Crime Fiction Festival in Houserwit, a Cumbrian village on which the entire publishing industry descends once a year. Jane has crept into the bookselling tent at 5 a.m, where everyone else is still sleeping off the excesses of the night before. Her plan was to take this opportunity to rearrange things, just a little. After all, it's not really fair that her books, all six of the excellent P.I. Sandra Baker series, are confined to the furthest corner of the highest shelf when they could be on the attractive table in the centre of the tent. People buy what they can see in front of them, and Jane was determined that someone would at least see her books. True, she has been sneakily rearranging bookshop shelves for months now, and it hasn't had any noticeable impact on sales. She isn't one to give up easily, though, and today might just have been the day that changed things. But finding the bookselling tent occupied has thrown a bit of a spanner in the works. No, reading crime novels can't be good for you at all. As she lies on her back, the milky whites of Carrie Marx's eyes stare up at the canvas ceiling of the temporary bookshop, her skin damp with morning dew and smudged coral lips slightly parted, a smear of blood under her nose. Carrie Marx, a literary agent who was revered and feared in equal measure, is still wearing her trademark tailoring, an anomaly in an industry full of floral print maxi dresses, but the silk of her blouse is stained and her mud-spattered skirt has ridden up to show a knobbly knee. Despite this rare glimpse of vulnerability, even in death, she looks as if she could eat you alive. It doesn't take an expert, and after writing 6 admittedly poorly selling novels on the subject of murder, Jane does consider herself one, to realise that Carrie Marks is dead. For the avoidance of any doubt, someone has stuck a large dagger through her heart and she's covered in blood. After boldly prodding Carrie's leg with one toe, Jane confirms this isn't some sort of feeble publicity stunt for a new novel. On the contrary, it looks as though this year's Killer Lines Crime Fiction Festival is about to get a lot more interesting.
Thank you so much. So I know the book isn't quite out in the UK yet, but I was wondering if you'd had any reaction or responses from your colleagues in the industry and what they thought of it.
Yeah, mostly positive. Well, I mean, the people who have told me about it, it's positive. They're not going to tell me otherwise. But I think most people in the industry share similar frustrations. So they responded well to that. It's always funny to see your own pain put down on the page. And it's fun to read about worlds you recognize. So yeah, mostly it's been positive. I had one author say that he learned more about the publishing industry by reading this book than he'd learned in 4 years of being published. Although I did, I went into my publishing offices and to meet some of the team I'd not met before. And my editor read out a line where I came across really badly because she thought it was funny. And I was like, what are you doing? I sound horrible. There's this one part where someone is pointing around at like other people who work in publishing, the marketers and the editors, etc. And she says, here it is. They all dream of swapping their puny salaries for a splashy book advance and having their colleagues wait on them for a change. And then she sort of looked at me and was like, almost like, how do you like me waiting on you? Because we used to work together, so I found that quite funny, but also excruciating. But yeah, mostly it's been good. I've had lots of people ask who certain characters are based on, but I won't be saying.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you after we'd stopped recording, but consider myself told. So you must read a lot as a book lover and someone that's worked in the industry for a while. What's on your reading list this summer?
Well, I've just been reading Agatha Christie because I've decided to collect a certain jacket look from the 70s. So I bought a big box of them and I'm going through them. But I'm going on my honeymoon in a few weeks and I'm desperately looking around for brilliant books to take with me. I think I might take Creation Lake, which is by Rachel Kushner. And also, I keep being told about All Fours by Miranda July. So potentially, I'm going to take that as well. And I also might try and find a copy of the new Marion Keyes book, which I think it's called My Favourite Mistake. But anything by Marion Keyes is fantastic. So
I love Marion Keyes. I last summer read every single Welsh Sisters book.
Love it. I got to meet her when I was an assistant, and it was I was so starstruck. I was like, Marion Keyes is in the office. So I'm a big fan.
Thank you so much for joining us, Eve. What's next? Is there another Jane book?
Yes. The next, I don't know if I can announce the title. I think I can. Let's say I can. It's called A Killer Plot. Or The Killer Plot. So that is what I'm working on at the moment, and that is Jane is in London. So it's London set, still publishing focused. There's still a good juicy murder that she's trying to solve. So I'm working on that at the moment.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. A Novel Murder is out very soon with Bonnie O'Zaffa, and you can pre-order it wherever you get your books. And if you'd like to win a copy, you can head over to our Instagram page at BTM Book Club to find out how you can do that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening to the Brighton Book Club. We will be back next month with our summer best of episode as we take a short break. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, where you can find details of everything we talked about on today's show. And if you have an idea for us, you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com.